You are listening to National Security Law Today.
I'm Elisa Poteet, and welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA's Standing Committee on Law and National Security. Tonight, as we record this episode, we're in the middle of historic national security law actions. The first is there's been a ceasefire that is currently being brokered between multiple nations in a joint massive effort to end the war in Gaza, Lebanon, and Israel. And in the middle of the negotiations is the United States, which is not a party to the conflict. And although negotiations took place in a time of transition between two administrations, it has become apparent that negotiators from both the Biden and the Trump administrations presented something almost delightful, and that is a unified front, apparently moving the deal forward. And then second, I don't think it's escaped anybody's notice that the Supreme Court issued an opinion that affirmed a D.C. Circuit opinion that held constitutional a law passed by Congress that required TikTok to become divested from its parent company, ByteDance, on national security grounds. And we'll talk about their reasons, their First Amendment analysis, and more details of that in the future. But first, to discuss the ceasefire deal, we turn to someone who knows how the State Department and the Secretary of State in particular function in these negotiations. Brian Egan is the former State Department legal advisor, the former deputy White House counsel, and more. We've had him on before. We'll hyperlink his bio, but he's now a partner at the law firm of Skadden Arps, and he can educate us on what the heck is going on here. Brian, thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure. It's great to be here. Thank you.
Let's talk generally about what this ceasefire involves and sort of bring us up to date as of this recording in terms of hostages released and things done.
So it is a both technically and politically complicated measure that Hamas, the Israelis, the United States, and the Qataris and the Egyptians have worked out. You'll hear talk about three phases. We are in the middle of phase one, which is a phase where both sides, Israel and Hamas, have agreed to a ceasefire in Gaza for at least 6 weeks. There is an exchange of prisoners that's going on immediately. Sunday the 19th, we've seen news of three Israelis who have been reunited with their families in Israel. There are about 90 Palestinians who will also be released, with more prisoners exchanges planned over the course of the next several weeks. This is very detailed. There are names that have been exchanged on each side, so that was all part of the negotiations. Israel agreed to pull out of Gaza, at least to withdraw within certain very heavily negotiated, demarcated lines, X hundred feet from different parts of heavily populated areas. And humanitarian aid has begun to flow. Brett McGurk earlier today said there are 800 trucks at the border crossing from Egypt ready to go that are gradually trickling into Gaza. So this is phase one. Phase two and phases three will be even more complicated. Phase two is a complete cessation of hostilities between both sides, specific terms still to be worked out, with additional prisoners to be exchanged at that point. So Israeli soldiers, at that point, uniformed Israeli military officials and personnel will be returned, and some of the militants on the Hamas side as well. And then phase three, which is even more ambitious, but is maybe even more important than anything else, is the reconstruction of Gaza. How that's going to go, who's going to pay for it, how the UN will be involved, how the Israelis, the Americans, et cetera, that is all still to be negotiated as well.
What I didn't hear you say, but I think is the question on a lot of national security lawyers' minds, is what does this do to the control by Hamas that's a designated foreign terrorist organization?
That's a great question. And that's one of the things that has to be resolved, at least on a more permanent basis, as part of phases two and three. Who will be the governing body in Gaza, in the West Bank for that matter? The Palestinian Authority, which has been recognized as the governing authority, has kind of submitted its application to be recognized as such. I'm not sure if that's going to be seen as acceptable to anyone, but they are the obvious default candidate here. I don't think that Hamas is going to emerge as the governing body in Gaza when the dust settles.
You mentioned the presence of 600 trucks at the border. Presumably, those would be carrying humanitarian supplies that would be available to persons in dire need right now in Gaza. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, and I welcome correction here, that there is a daily limit of 600 trucks. It seems that the Israelis have somehow quantified a number above which they can't perhaps inspect and ensure that weapons aren't coming in, that Hamas's long and documented history of using hearts and minds, and there's the CAT committees, you know, to rearm Hamas doesn't occur through some abuse of the humanitarian process, as unfortunately has happened in the past. Did I get that right or not?
Yeah, that's certainly I think the Israelis' perspective is there are limits, and the Egyptians for that matter too. This is their border. There are limits to what can safely be inspected and processed on a daily basis. I think even the numbers that we're looking at now, 600, some have reported 800, would be pretty ambitious, as I understand it, to get through a single border crossing. I think that's something that will be critical moving from phase one to phase two is the success in not only just getting the aid into Gaza, but then successfully delivering the aid to where it's needed. And among many complicated factors to be worked out is really the role of UN relief organizations in helping to deliver that aid in Gaza. Another source of contention with the Israeli government is whether UNRWA, in particular, the UN Relief Works Agency, is an appropriate partner for things like that.
Right. And just to recap for our listeners, that particular UN-created entity was accused of having individuals that somehow colluded in the October 7th attacks. And that could happen to any aid organization that relies on locals. And that certainly has happened in other conflict zones, including Somalia in the early 1990s, and certainly in Afghanistan. But also, I think I raised the issue of the number of trucks per day because this is the level of minutia, apparently, that has been involved. So what is the role of a U.S. Secretary of State in working conflict resolutions such as ceasefires and peace agreements? And what standing, if you will, I like a legal term like that, does he even have in a situation when the United States is not a party to the conflict, right?
Yeah, the United States certainly would take the position they're not a party to this conflict. But I think all sides, to include Hamas, but also certainly the Israelis, the Qataris, other Gulf countries, have seen the United States as critical to these negotiations. They're someone who is seen as someone who can drive a bargain on both sides that can be lived with. Looking back really to World War II, the United States has played that role and thus far unsuccessful quest to bring some sort of a lasting change to the political situation in the region, where the U.S., to some extent the U.K., to some extent Gulf partners along the ways, have tried to figure out a way to bring peace and security both to the Israeli people and the Palestinian people through a political solution that still remains elusive at this point. As much as people like to criticize the United States and its role and imperialism and its overreach outside its borders, this is an area where I think U.S. involvement really was absolutely essential. And I think all sides would acknowledge that.
Yes. And you talk about a lasting peace. We certainly have tried. There have been some sort of negative consequences of things, including the Oslo Accords over the years, which seem to inflame a lot of Palestinians who felt somehow betrayed. It's just an interesting thing that we were in the middle of that one too, and it had a sort of a triggering consequence for a lot of people. So the Secretary of State is just sort of the Uber negotiator that comes in. But in this case, we're in a time of transition, and this has been Anthony Blinken, who's probably not been home very much for the last 4 years, although I think he has young children. And I wonder what life is like for him right now and to what extent he might lean on the State Department legal advisor and whether any leaning is sort of within the role of the State Department legal advisor, which I would point out is not the same thing as a general counsel. It's got a different title, which means I assume it's not the envisioned general counsel, I guess, Hamilton had so many years ago.
Yeah, I'm sure Secretary Blinken is going to take a long nap because he's been a very busy man, as has the president's special envoy for the Middle East, Brett McGurk, who has just been tirelessly working this issue over the last few months in particular, but well beyond that as well. You asked about the role that the legal advisor, who's the chief lawyer at the State Department and plays a role in international law more broadly within the US government, what role that person plays in these negotiations. I would take the question a bit broader and talk a little bit about the role the Office of the Legal Advisor, or L, as it's known in state, plays in this type of a conflict, because they get involved early and often, I would say, on a range of issues. You think about, for one, the United States' position on issues relating to the conflict itself. There's been a lot of criticism of both Hamas and of the Israelis on how they have gone about fighting each other in this conflict. Lots of civilian casualties. The State Department plays a role in advising the Secretary on the laws of war, international humanitarian law, helps the U.S. government come up with its positions on those issues, some of which are said publicly, some of which are said privately to the parties to the conflict, et cetera. That's a role that L kind of plays the lead role in the U.S. government on. Second is delivery of weapons. Throughout the conflict, the U.S. has provided a lot of weapons and military equipment to the Israelis. The State Department advises on laws that are called the Leahy Laws, which prohibit the U.S. government from providing military assistance to units engaged in gross human rights violations. State Department and DOD kind of implement this law. There's been some criticism that the Leahy Laws, in this case, were not used to stop the flow of any assistance to Israeli military units along the way. That's a role that State L plays a big part in helping policymakers understand how that law works. Third is things like the International Court of Justice proceedings involving the situation in Gaza, where, again, the U.S. was not a party to those proceedings, but we filed an advisory opinion with the ICJ in those proceedings. That's something the State Department legal office leads. And then fourth is, as you said, Elisa, the statements, the text of the ceasefire, statements made around the ceasefire, those are things that are negotiated politically, but the legal advisor and her staff, Margaret Taylor is the current legal advisor, are instrumental in making sure policymakers are both technically writing things down that are consistent with how we think about these types of instruments and saying things about the conflict and U.S. position that's consistent with, for example, UN Security Council resolutions going back many decades on the situation between the Israelis and the Palestinians. So in all of those ways, the legal advisor and her team have played a really important role in getting to where we are today.
That's interesting. And just to recap, though, you mentioned the ICJ. There were individuals who were, I guess, indicted is the term that they used, or charged. They included Israelis.
Yes. And the ICC, the International Criminal Court, has warrants out for the arrest of some high-ranking Israeli officials. That's right.
Let's move on. This is a weird time because we're in a transition from one administration to the next. And I think in the past, people have always had a fear that foreign governments would take advantage of this situation and try to pit the two parties against each other, maybe use that opportunity to stage an attack somewhere in the belief that there wouldn't be continuity of government as they understand it, not as we understand it. But it's very clear that there's been good cooperation, apparently, between the Biden team and the Trump team, understanding that no one has yet been formally nominated or confirmed because the president is not in office until tomorrow. How does state handle a civilian who might participate in negotiations who could later become a government official or a cabinet member or may not? I mean, I feel like we've heard of this before.
Yeah, I would agree, first of all, that this has been a remarkable amount of coordination between the two administrations, and not just thinking about President Trump and President Biden kind of not getting along in a lot of policy issues. I think going back historically, this amount of coordination between a president who lost an election and a president who won an election on one of the key foreign policy issues of our time is really quite remarkable. You think about the Iran hostage crisis, for example, which some think was a downfall of the Jimmy Carter presidency, where there have been rumors that President Reagan's people were actually discouraging the release of the hostages until after the election, so that President Carter couldn't claim victory on that issue. I don't know if that were true or not.
But the Algiers Accords, right? I mean,
Yeah, and the hostages, in fact, weren't released until after President Carter left office. So,
well, until their money, Iran's money was freed up, right?
True.
Yeah, I mean, that could have happened during either administration, but it went into effect the second time. But you're right, it made political hay. I'm sure there were people who perceived Carter in that moment as not as strong as Reagan, just because of the way he handled himself.
But you didn't have Carter's envoy and Reagan's envoy talking on a daily basis to make sure that all of the I's were dotted and the T's were crossed. Although the Algiers report were even more complicated in some ways than the agreement we just reached here. I think the fact that, as you suggest, Elisa, it's politically complicated, not just from a domestic politics perspective, but the Trump team is not governing the United States until noon tomorrow. So you're dealing with a transition team, basically, that doesn't have any authority, but has a lot of persuasive authority. And I think the fact that Brett McGurk and his incoming counterpart, his replacement, a guy named Steve Witkoff, have been in, it sounds like, daily communication, at least over the last several weeks, have both been meeting with the Israeli government in particular. I don't think that this would have happened without that. And you hear some of the headlines about President Trump and President Biden kind of bickering over who should get credit. I think when you look at what really happened, it's pretty clear they both should get credit for this. I also think that is just a good sign for what's going to be an even more difficult set of negotiations coming forward, where you have the Trump team basically all in on the three-phased approach, which they have to be, because 2 weeks from now, the negotiations on phase two have to begin. Again, the U.S. is going to play a huge role. Mr. Witkoff, no doubt, will play a huge role. And so this transition coordination was essential to making this happen.
Yeah, I actually viewed it as very positive when I was reading about it this morning. There was excellent coverage in the Washington Post sort of describing Witkoff's statement, I guess, to parties that, you know, you don't wait for us and assume anything's going to be different. It's not going to be, you know, presenting a unified front seems to be something that's in the interest of the United States, not just here, but in a lot of international situations. So I considered it very positive. I just was not aware, my history of knowledge being thin on this point, as to whether or not something like this had ever happened. And politics being such high stakes, dirty business, it's refreshing to think that this kind of thing might have been happening. Now, with respect to phase two, one of the things that was expressed as concern that Mr. Netanyahu is facing right now is he has a growing conservative majority because of the numbers of children that are being had by the families of conservative Jews. And there's some concern that Israel become a theocracy, no different from a Muslim theocracy, and that this will drive Israel into a situation where no leader can make a choice that is ultimately in the interest of all Israelis. Again, having a unified, strong United States obviously signals, I think, everyone in Israel that there's not going to be some quick shifting thing where Israel can take advantage in a different direction. I think that probably inspires some confidence, I would like to believe, among the Palestinians that this thing is worth their time and they should sign on for it.
I think the three-phased approach is something that, you know, really was laid out by the United States in the spring. So this plan has been around for several months now. It was endorsed by the Security Council, one of the few, I would say, meaningful votes taken by the Security Council, 14-0-1. Russia abstained. China voted for it. So you've got the entire weight of the world behind this plan. Mr. Netanyahu, you know, I don't downplay the difficulties of his domestic politics. His national security advisor resigned from the cabinet in protest, which was not a surprise, apparently. But he's got some difficult constituencies on his side, including some on the left, who think this should have been agreed to 9 months ago. So it's not going to be easy, but I totally agree that the U.S. showing continuity here and coordination and, frankly, strength at the end of the process, I think is helpful to the Israeli leadership in showing this is really the game that we've got to play.
Let me go to another topic here, which is that there are a lot of players. I find that it's been interesting. So you've got Egypt, you've got Qatar. What happens and where is the legal advisor sort of wedged into this when you have all of these countries involved in all of these equities? I mean, do they have lawyers reviewing everything? I would presume so. What does that look like on the legal side and inside of state?
On the one hand, you have the specifics of how hopefully a cessation, a permanent or indefinite cessation of hostilities will take place. You know, what do those final prisoner swaps look like? What does the humanitarian assistance program look like moving forward? How free are Palestinians going to be to move within Gaza? Who will be in charge of security in Gaza? Will the Israelis have a presence at all in Gaza, et cetera? You've got a lot of questions that are really complicated politically and factually, but then writing those down in a way that is clear and is agreed to by all sides almost inevitably has lawyers involved. You also have the words of the agreement, if you will. Hamas, of course, they're not a government. They're not a country. They don't run in the Palestinian territories, at least in the United States view, that they're not a country. So you're not negotiating a classic treaty here. This is a government, the Israeli government, negotiating with a non-state actor that's seen as a terrorist organization by a lot of the Western world. That kind of changes the way that you may approach not only the negotiation, but also the quote agreement that you might come to at the end of the day. It's not going to look like the Algiers Accords, for example, which were with the Iranian government. Those are issues. And then third, you've got in the background, what commitments or obligations have countries taken on under old Security Council resolutions, which are binding on all countries, in how the situation in the Palestinian territories ultimately will be resolved. U.S. and state and the legal advisor will be thinking about at least not wanting to unintentionally cross lines in those areas. I think one of the many, many issues to be wrestled with by the incoming administration and all the parties is to what extent, in order to get to phase three and phase 2.5, will we need to rethink anything that has been agreed to in the past? I think that's going to be a huge issue, but the legal advisor will play a big role in that.
I want to just add a little embroidery to something that you just said, which is that, you know, Hamas is seen as a terror organization. The State Department is heavily involved in these negotiations. It's the very same agency that put together a packet and concluded that Hamas was engaged in terrorist activity and designated them a foreign terrorist group. I imagine this has happened before, and I think it's happening right now a bit in Syria, where you have an organization that was previously called the Al-Nusra Front, which is now called something else, but may effectively become the government in Syria and may or may not sort of lose its violent Islamist earlier claims and leanings. But at some point, sometimes these organizations end up ruling a place. And if you don't deal with them, what? I mean, who are you going to deal with? And I know a lot of Palestinians have said publicly that Hamas does not speak for them.
That's right. And I think that's where the role of the Qatari government has been just so important here. Doha is the current home of the Hamas political office. The prime minister of Qatar has personally been involved for days in literally shepherding messages back and forth between the Israelis and Hamas. I don't think the United States, at least it hasn't been publicly reported, that they've been directly involved in discussions with Hamas. And that's, I think, in part because of what you said, that we generally don't negotiate directly with terrorist groups. But if you look back in history, there are times when, as a practical matter, you've got to figure out a way to reach some sort of an agreement. You think as recently as Trump administration dealing with the Taliban, again, through Qatar, where the Secretary of State, Secretary Pompeo, was working on the agreement that would result in the United States withdrawing from Afghanistan. So I think it's important in some to put other issues aside and sometimes in the interests of peace and security in figuring out what to do in a situation like this.
I think you've talked a little bit about which international laws govern these peace negotiations in reality, and you cite to the UN. You want to go back over that a little bit. I know there are a number of international treaties and obviously the Geneva Conventions and a lot of things that sort of govern how these things are managed. Do you want to sort of run through really quickly what those are?
So on the international humanitarian law or law of war front, there are customary international law principles, so things that are generally agreed to by all countries. There are treaty-based international law principles from the Geneva Conventions and other things that not only govern the conduct of war, things like when is it appropriate to target a particular facility, but also the treatment of prisoners of war, the treatment of civilians in war, the treatment, if you're an occupied power, your responsibilities as an occupied power. And so in the background of some of the humanitarian considerations in particular, maybe any prosecutions of war criminals, decisions about who should and shouldn't be released as prisoners are international law considerations. And the United States would certainly play a role in the negotiations in thinking through those issues. Second set of issues relates to the status of the Palestinian territories of Gaza and West Bank, which have been under dispute really for 80 years at this point. The UN Security Council has, and the parties along the way, have agreed to try to come up with a solution that could result in self-governance for the Palestinians. It's been talked about as a two-state solution. That's the U.S. policy it's been for a long time. Changing that approach, if there was a decision to do so, would go against some UN resolutions that have been agreed to in the past, many of which are legally binding as a matter of international law. The legal advisor and the team at State who advises the secretary on those issues will be very much involved if there is a change in any of those approaches.
It looks like Marco Rubio will be formally nominated. And I wonder if you have some thoughts on what will be his biggest challenges he'll face on day one, should he be confirmed?
Yeah, this issue, along with maybe the Russia-Ukraine issue, are going to have to be the top of his agenda, I would think, including from day one. You know, this ceasefire is very fragile. We've seen the public reports that the Israelis were still continuing military activities that resulted in dozens of deaths right up until the moment of the ceasefire. You saw reports that Hamas was delayed in several hours in releasing even the first three Israeli prisoners. So this could really not hold. And the secretary will be the key U.S. spokesperson along with Mr. Witkoff in addressing that. So he will be very busy on this issue almost from the very first day in office. And what is his approach going to be? I think he is in his confirmation hearing, he referred to, and I think he supports the three-phased approach. I think he was appreciative of both the Biden administration and Mr. Witkoff's efforts to bridge the gap here. But this will become, you know, his docket.
Okay, but that also begs the question of what you expect the immediate challenges to be to the new legal advisor. And is there a new legal advisor? That is a political position, correct?
That is a political position. Senate confirmation is required. The Senate just frankly doesn't have a great track record in confirming legal advisors over the past three administrations. Margaret Taylor, who's the legal advisor, she was in her job for a grand total of 4 months. She was the only Senate confirmed legal advisor in the entire Biden administration. In the first Trump administration, we had Jennifer Newstead, who was legal advisor for a little over a year. No other Senate confirmed candidate made their way through. And then in the Obama administration, you had Harold Coe, and then at the very end, myself. But these nominations just don't get through the White House. They don't get through the Senate very quickly. And I think this is the time. I would just urge the administration to figure out who their nominee is. And I would urge the Senate Foreign Relations Committee to really focus on this person, because the legal advisor is not just the general counsel of the State Department. They are the international law spokesperson for the United States. And we have always led on these issues of international law that are key to things like the Gaza conflict. We should continue to lead. I think it's a nonpartisan issue that we should be out in front. There may be differences of views on exactly what our international law position should be, but I don't think there should be a difference of views that we should be leading the world in these areas. And we need somebody who can be that person, who needs to be political. We need a Trump person to be taken that position. So I really hope that we can see a nominee in the not too distant future.
Yes, let's hope so. I think the last question that I have is, I'm mindful that we have some fellows right now that are working in my office. And I know that when there was a belief that there was a peace negotiation underway, there was going to be a ceasefire, they were excited. This was a big deal to them. And I think I'm asking for them, what do you think that these young lawyers who might be interested in pursuing careers in sort of international conflict resolution, what do you think they should be thinking about before they dive in, other than the obvious that you'll be on the road a lot.
Yeah, compromise is really the key. It's some ways it's no different than any other negotiation, but the stakes are greater, and it's hard in today's world to compromise. This agreement, you know, is not something that either side would have signed off with on day one. So compromise is key, and I'd say tenacity is key as well. This literally was put on the table and endorsed 9 months ago. Hamas backed away to the extent that the Qataris almost said, we are not mediating this dispute anymore. We're walking away. The Israelis and the Israeli government almost walked away. And so thinking about sticking to your guns in some ways, moving on the edges, which I think clearly happened, is important. But and behind all of that in some way is at least some sort of empathy, that you've got to have some appreciation for each side to the dispute. And you've got to show that you're an honest broker in some ways, even if you may have a foot on the pedal on one side or the other. I think that's where the United States, the Qataris, the Egyptians have really played an important role in these discussions, is making each side at least hear the other side's position. It's a fascinating area. It's a fascinating time. We need international negotiators. I mean, Russia-Ukraine is staring us in the face as a conflict that we need to figure out a way to resolve. That's going to require some compromise. It's going to require some tenacity. It's going to require some third parties who are willing to get in the room. And lawyers are kind of hardwired to do those things. So if you're thinking about getting involved in those areas and you have a background in law and international law in particular, I'd say this is actually a good time to be interested in those issues.
Well, on that note, let me just say thank you for coming in. We may ask to talk to you again in a few months as this thing unfolds.
Great to be here.
Thanks, Brian. All right, now we're going to turn to the Supreme Court's per curiam opinion in TikTok versus Garland. And our guest again is the man in the know, Glenn Kirstall, the former general counsel of the National Security Agency, now at CSIS. Glenn, we had a per curiam and then we had two concurrences. What were the big takeaways from the Supreme Court here?
First, I would say that anyone who had listened to the oral argument the prior week, again, just a week to issue the opinion, would have come away with the conclusion that TikTok faced a very, very uphill fight. And the opinion certainly reflected that. It was a unanimous opinion on the judgment affirming the decision of the lower court, the DC Court of Appeals. The two justices had concurring opinions, Sotomayor and Gorsuch, but agreeing in the final judgment. The essence of the opinion was that it showed a significant level of deference to the executive branch's decision and Congress's decision about the nature of the national security threat. Just backing up for a second to the oral arguments which we discussed last time, TikTok started out its oral arguments saying this is a free speech burden on us, even though the law is aimed merely at corporate control, not about content. The law doesn't specifically say anything about the content on TikTok. It talks about who owns TikTok. And so TikTok started its argument by saying the First Amendment applies because it levies a burden on us, even though the law is aimed at corporate structure. But it in fact affects the content on TikTok because it would cause it to be shut down and eliminate the editorial discretion, the curating, the algorithms that the TikTok was able to offer. Interestingly enough, they didn't have much opportunity in the oral argument to move to the second part of their argument, which is that, assuming there is indeed a First Amendment infringement here, is it a permitted one? What level of scrutiny applies to it? And does the evidence meet that particular test? They never got to that space. The entire oral argument was kept on the very first part. The justices didn't get off that point. So now moving to the opinion. As a result, the opinion doesn't really get to that second question in great depth of, namely, just how strong is the evidence that TikTok is a national security threat? Instead, the opinion starts off by examining the threshold question of whether the First Amendment even applies at all. Somewhat surprisingly, at least to me, the court says, we're just going to assume the First Amendment applies. And let me read you the one key paragraph, if I may. This court has not articulated a clear framework for determining whether a regulation of non-expressive activity, meaning the corporate structure point here, that disproportionately burdens those engaged in expressive activity, meaning the TikTok platform, triggers heightened review. We need not do so here. We assume without deciding that the challenge provisions fall within this category and are subject to First Amendment scrutiny. They then move very quickly to the determination that this doesn't require the toughest standard of that scrutiny, the so-called strict scrutiny, but instead intermediate scrutiny, and that's the end of the battle. Once they reach that decision, it's pretty clear to the justices that meeting this middle and somewhat lower threshold, all they need to do is make a determination that the executive branch has found there's a national security threat here. They are going to be deferential to it. It's not particularly deeply examining that particular point. And they therefore conclude that the First Amendment infringement, such as it is an acceptable one. So that's the essence of the opinion.
So they put their eggs, TikTok did, in one basket. And let me just mention, they issued a video and CEO Xu Zhichu was featured in that video. He recorded, I presume, somewhere in Singapore, which is where he actually resides. He began by saying, we're fighting this. This has to do with constitutional protections only, First Amendment. It is arbitrary censorship, which, you know, no court has found that it is. In fact, it's been deemed a content neutral law. And the TikTok video that he issued and sort of other pieces came from not just TikTok itself, but also from a committee known as Project Liberty. And let's just say behind Project Liberty is a donor who donates not just to President Trump, but I want to be clear, he donates to Democrats as well. And that's Frank McCourt, who some people may remember is a guy who at some point owned the Los Angeles Dodgers. He is the donor behind the business school at Georgetown University. He gives a lot of money to a lot of causes, but it appears that collectively, all people with interests pushed this narrative of First Amendment, which proved to be a miscalculation. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but when we get to Gorsuch's concurrence, does he not get to the point where he says strict scrutiny would apply? And even if it did, TikTok loses.
That's right. He had an opinion that basically said, I think we need to move slowly here. I'm not 100% sure of the legal reasoning in this case. He takes some shots at some of the legal reasoning, but says, I'm not sure it's wrong, but I'm not sure it's right either. We've had only a week to consider these incredibly complex questions with important, significant ramifications for other First Amendment issues, how we treat social media, et cetera. And so he says, I'm agreeing at the end result, but I'm not so sure this is all the right reasoning and that we need to be bound by it, in effect, including his point that he thinks probably the higher standard, strict scrutiny, would be the right one to apply, although he concedes that even under that one, he would still go ahead with the judgment, which he did. From TikTok's point of view, I think they have to recognize that on both the public relations front and the legal front, their strategy has been a complete failure. They've not been able to shift this debate in their direction at all.
I do wonder if there was greater candor about ownership of TikTok, if it might actually help resolve this issue. And I say that because I've mentioned McCourt, who is an equal opportunity donor to both parties, is heavily invested. But so is Jeffrey Yass, Susquehanna, and other big funds, many of which have institutional investors, pension funds, and the like. And these are big players in the U.S. economy. But the Jeffrey Yass, of course, is the biggest institutional shareholder. And I mention that only because his company, Sequoia Capital, merged with Trump's, what is it called, Truth Social? Or it's part of Truth Social now. It invested in Truth Social. I'm sure they've invested in other Democratic things. But the issue here, too, is Sequoia has invested $1 billion in Chinese semiconductor industry just since 2001. And so now that's deemed a national security threat. And I think there are a lot of financial interests. And I'm not just talking about these wealthy guys, but once you have institutional investors in some of these funds, the potential impact financially is large. So he's got 90 days for the president and Congress to work this out.
Well, that's not 100% clear. We should talk about that. But let me go back to the point you raised about whether maybe it would have had a different outcome had TikTok been more upfront about its corporate ownership. I think there probably was an opportunity, maybe about 2 years ago, for this to go in a different direction. I think had TikTok been more alert to the completely legitimate concerns over Chinese control and ownership and the 2017 national security law of China that would require ByteDance, a Chinese company, the corporate parent of TikTok, to hand over user data if indeed the PRC government so demanded it. I think had TikTok probably been more sensitive to that, had they been a little more willing in the original Project Texas negotiations to make some concessions up front, and most importantly, the external environment. We have to remember that, you know, we're dealing with a situation with significant Chinese cyber mischief over the last 2 years, with Volt Typhoon and Salt Typhoon, two cyber actors, malicious cyber actors penetrating infrastructure, communications, the United States Treasury Department most recently. So the external environment certainly was not attractive. But to your point about the corporate structure, yes, a ByteDance, the corporate parent, does indeed have very substantial U.S. Investors. I believe KKR has been mentioned. You mentioned General Atlantic, Susquehanna International, et cetera. So it has
gotten to Atlantic. Kudos for you, because they are invested and they have institutional investors.
And I think one of their members may be on the board of TikTok. So this is a significant issue, and it's going to have a very, very substantial financial impact on ByteDance if indeed the app remains closed in the United States. That's because there's 170 million users here. They contribute, I think, something in the nature of about $6 billion of advertising revenue. TikTok is one of the largest places for digital ads in the United States. So this is going to have a significant effect, not fatal because ByteDance is still a massive company, but it will have a significant effect on their revenues and will even affect TikTok elsewhere in the world. There's about another 1.5 billion, 1.6 billion users around the world who use TikTok, who will now not have access to U.S. content, which is what made TikTok attractive in many respects. So this is a very, very significant economic issue as well.
We all imagine that we can attack, you know, who we perceive as villains, and we can get rid of a company and we'll have no secondary, tertiary consequences. I think it's not realistic to expect that this won't have an impact on some U.S. investors and corporations who have divergent, sometimes political interest or partisan support, but it will have an impact on that.
Quick point, and also it will impact other domestic social media. This will probably cause their users or many TikTok users to go to YouTube, to Instagram, et cetera. So there's a domestic effect too, as well as Chinese apps such as Red Note.
Right, but 2 points on that. One is, boohoo, they're coming to our social media oligarchs, if you will. But the second thing I think that's important to also make plain right now is Krebs on Security has reported that there are now in Google searches listed a lot of virtual private network services. And I just want you to know that many of them are spurious. They're deploying malware. If you are a national security lawyer, if for some reason you have anybody in your family who is getting on TikTok, they need to read Krebs on Security, because a lot of these aren't even VPNs. You are acting impulsively. If you're grabbing these companies you know nothing about, and you need to identify reputable companies, have your children, you know, around you do that. If they must try to circumvent this, or they want to start using a VPN, you can immediately create a security problem for your family. But onto the 90 days.
I couldn't agree more with that. The VPN market always had more than a couple of sketchy operators. Now they've proliferated with apparent demise or temporary demise of TikTok. And, you know, once you authorize a VPN provider to have access to your computer, they know certainly about every website you're visiting, and potentially some of them load all sorts of other malware on top of your computer. So your comment is 100%. Let me just also add that even if you have a perfectly good VPN, a highly rated VPN, it's not at all clear that that necessarily provides an adequate workaround. There have been some reported cases where people who have U.S. accounts are still not able to access TikTok, even if they use a VPN overseas. Anyway, back to you.
Actually, back to you. So we've got 90 days. So the statute at issue in the Supreme Court opinion had one escape valve, I'll call it, and that allowed for a one-time 90-day delay, during which time something could be worked out. Now, I suspect negotiations are fast and furious, but it doesn't change yet the fact that ByteDance, the PRC, have said that they're not going to allow the disaggregation or the divestiture. Assuming arguendo, and let me add, Glenn, because I just wanted to let you have a fact to chew on. I took a look at how many people on the Hill have been missing votes. And I don't mean a few. There are members of Congress who, for health reasons, one of whom has literally disappeared from view for months. I just want to make clear right now, according to the GovTrack and congressional reports, like Kay Granger from Florida, she's a Fort Worth Republican, missing. I don't know what's going to happen to her seat. I think they're working on it, but she hasn't been around now for 120 days. You've got a list right now that includes a number of Democrats who are going to have comments on these things at a later date, right? Raul Grijalva, Ted Lieu, a lot of these people have missed an enormous number of votes, some of them over a period of months. And this is very important national security legislation. Many of the people identified are on meaningful committees, committees that would be involved in this. So I'm a little concerned about which direction this could go if there's not a lot of input from people.
So you're right. It looks like the ball is going to go back into Congress's court, and you are correct that they're going to have to muster probably a bipartisan majority to do anything if they wish to change the law. But let's take a step back here for a second. You touched on something important about what the status of the situation is. So as we all know, TikTok went dark late Saturday night, right before the midnight deadline on Sunday, with a message saying, we're gone, seemingly, possibly temporarily. Then they came back up Sunday afternoon with lavish praise of President Trump and saying we're back on. I don't think, at least as of this morning, that it was in the app stores yet. I believe it's still out of Apple and Google app stores, but evidently it is still being hosted by Oracle in, I'll say, seeming violation of the statutory ban that went into effect at midnight on Sunday. All the discussions have not changed the fact that the statute is in effect and was upheld by the Supreme Court. There are basically sort of three ways out of this under the statute and one that's not in the statute. The one that's not in the statute is simply for the president to instruct the Department of Justice to not enforce the statute. That could be true of any congressional enactment. The president could decline to enforce it. Obviously, there's a tension there because the president has taken an oath, both Biden and now Trump again, to uphold and enforce the laws. So there's a question about, an unresolved question about, the extent to which, as a matter of discretion, the president can tell his Justice Department, don't enforce a law that's been approved by Congress and upheld by the Supreme Court. Put that aside for a second, because you can imagine if you were the general counsel of Google or Apple and were asked, is it okay for us to defy the law when the president has said he's not going to go after us? That's a big question. So put that aside for a second. Then under the statute, there's a couple of options. One is, before the ban has gone into effect, a qualified divestiture could be determined to have occurred. Namely, TikTok would have sold it to a non-Chinese person. That didn't happen. Two is, after the ban goes into effect, a qualified divestiture, that's a term defined in the statute, could occur at any time. And that, again, would mean that China no longer owns or controls the app. There's no longer an arrangement with China to control the algorithm. Basically, it's in the hands and control of a non-foreign adversary. That might happen at some point, but that hasn't happened yet. That would require a presidential determination for that to have occurred. And it's not just something that it might occur in the future. It has to be in effect in order for qualified divestiture. And the last one, which is the one you've alluded to, which is the one that seems to be getting most press attention, is a provision in the statute that says, apparently before the ban has gone into effect, the president can give a one-time 90-day extension if a deal is in progress, if a deal is in the works, legally binding documents have been executed, and, quote, a path to executing a qualified divestiture has been identified, some other details, and there's, quote, evidence of significant progress toward the deal. So if those findings are made, the president could give a one-time 90-day extension. The way the statute's written, I think any fair interpretation of the statute, although it doesn't literally say prior to the ban, I think that's probably the clear intent given the way that statutory language appears, and given that when Congress wanted to make the distinction between before and after the ban and the qualified divestiture, a mere two sentences later, it certainly was able to do so. And then finally, in case there was any doubt about what I think is the plain meaning of the statute, the Supreme Court, although it wasn't ruling on the question, said in dictum, and I'll read the quote, the act permits the president to grant a one-time extension of no more than 90 days with respect to the prohibition's 270-day effective date if the president makes certain. So it's an extension of the prohibition's 270 effective date. Well, that obviously must mean it has to occur before January 19th. So I think there's a real open question. Obviously, Trump can go ahead and issue an executive order. Maybe internet providers would feel comfortable relying on it. But in terms of the finding bedrock in the statute, I think that's a tough case.
Well, I find it interesting you say that. I mean, just as a highly technical matter, let's be real. I mean, Trump wasn't president when this expired. So that really would have fallen to Biden, and Biden.
Yeah, and Biden had the opportunity to do so and did not do so. I think a perfectly respectable, if not very strong, statutory argument can be made that that one-time 90-day window possibility has now closed. It's not available to anybody.
Yeah. So tell me how this works. The president's Truth Social, I don't know, does he still have ownership in that since it's part of Sequoia? Yeah,
I believe
and
so.
Sequoia is invested in TikTok. How do you have to manage what is a potential financial conflict of interest? And I mean, I don't know, but my guess is a number of members of Congress of both parties need to look closely at their own holdings and their own potential financial interests here.
Well, the financial interests are just one part of the complication. And then, of course, there's this sort of bigger political issue, which is several years ago, Trump was adamantly opposed to TikTok after the campaign where he had, I believe, almost 14 million followers on TikTok. He now is in favor of, quote, finding a solution to saving TikTok. And that, I might add, runs counter to many members of his own party. Senator Cotton was very clear over the weekend that he thought it critical that the ban be enforced and that there be no attempted 90-day extension or attempt to find a qualified divestiture unless there really was an absence of Chinese control. Congressman John Molinor, who's the head of the Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party, applauded the decision and made it very clear that he thought it critical that the ban not be waived or extended or put aside. So you've got some members of Congress who feel very strongly about the national security issue here, and they're not going along with apparently the route that President Trump might be going down.
Yes, and let's just refresh people's memory. So in August of 2020, and this is in the Supreme Court opinion, we're not just freewheeling here, President Trump issued an executive order, which was number 13942. You can find it at 3 CFR 412. And in that order, he made some findings regarding TikTok, and he determined that TikTok raised, quote, particular concerns, noting that the platform automatically captures vast swaths of information from its users and is susceptible to being used to further the interests of the Chinese government. And it prohibited certain transactions involving ByteDance or its subsidiaries, meaning TikTok. So this is a very big change of tune. I'm hoping that this is treated as a serious national security concern and managed accordingly, as opposed to a simple financial concern. Although I know finances and national security, or in particular our economy, are inextricably intertwined no matter what we do.
Well, there's also just the simple political popular question of taking away an app that about one out of every two Americans is using. And, you know, we haven't had a good history about 100-odd years ago of taking things away from Americans that were sort of popular and whatever in the form of prohibition.
Well, and it may not be the same reality, because I think you refer to prohibition, alcohol prohibition, which, you know, arguably spawned what became the first sort of drug addictive crisis in this country. But that's not the case here, because there are alternatives. There are meta products that function equivalently. And there are somewhere out there is a startup that maybe has an even better algorithm and may ultimately siphon off. So I guess I don't see it as a deprivation of something. Now, clearly all of these social media platforms are dispensing dopamine hits to people looking at it. All that is stuff that people are going to have to learn how to manage. They're going to have to grow out of this dependency on social media as a form of filling the boredom. There will be consequences, obviously, academically to U.S. students and otherwise. There's very strong indication from research right now that this is contributing to, you know, acute depression and anxiety in young people. Americans are nimble. They can pivot quickly. They can adjust. And if they enjoy this, if this is how they choose to entertain themselves in lieu of a deeper education, they will find a way, and we have that way. So I guess I want to just state that I don't know that this is going to have that ramification. I wonder, because you are more knowledgeable in this area, what I wonder is how the Chinese are going to retaliate, because they do retaliate.
You're right that it's not clear what effect this would have if indeed the app was taken away. And it's not even a perfect analogy, as in India banned TikTok. But that was at the height of open hostilities with China. There was a lot of anti-Chinese sentiment in India at the time because of physical border clashes. So it's not quite the same. So it's a little hard to predict what the sort of popular backlash might be or not, as the case may be, if TikTok is really taken away. As to what's going to happen, I hate to make predictions because I'm almost surely going to be wrong, but it sounds like President Trump is going to, at a minimum, say he's not going to prosecute violations of the ban while a deal is being worked on. I think he's going to engage directly with the PRC government in some form. There's already been a phone call that was discussed between President-elect Trump and President Xi, apparently touching on TikTok. So I think there's great pressure on both sides, China and the U.S., to try to resolve this in some way. It would be in their interest from their point of view. But again, we've got to have the national security threat addressed, and that's going to mean taking this out of Chinese hands. And I think that's going to be a very tough thing for China to accept. Maybe it's part of a broader deal with something else where they'll agree to do something else in return for giving up the algorithm. Who knows? President Trump is going to try to negotiate something significant, I would imagine. It's possible that none of these efforts will be successful. They're all sort of extra legal. They're political and geopolitical. And the app will, in fact, go dead in the United States. I think it's tough to see app stores carrying it, given the risk that the very significant financial risks they would incur, even if the government says they're not going to prosecute. TikTok could probably survive without new ads from app stores. You could also download it from an app store outside the United States. But they can't survive if there's no internet hosting in the United States. Maybe they could shift to offshore hosting. Maybe that would work. Not at all clear. But their options are quite limited.
Yeah, and a lot of those can be defeated. Let me just point out that at least the Apple App Store says TikTok and other ByteDance apps are not available in your country or region. Mm-hmm. And this is effective Sunday morning. But back to potential secondary consequences. So I have a few thoughts from my very untutored, less experienced brain on this. But the first is that I have observed and read about many efforts by China, again, to enter areas, physical areas, and develop relationships throughout Africa and the rest of the world in order to lock down critical minerals. And those critical minerals are essential to chips that are used in all kinds of things, including our defense industry. So, you know, if this becomes a tit for tat and China locks down on that, there may ultimately be an answer. Now, I know developing a mine is not something that happens overnight. It's like bringing a nuclear power plant online. But nevertheless, I think that some version of something that they already control that we need will probably be how they will manage this, at least initially. It'll be subtle and probably not as obvious until it's a real crisis. What are your closing thoughts here, Glenn?
As I've said before, I think on the Supreme Court case, this shows a significant deference on the part of the judiciary to national security determinations by the executive and by Congress. And in case you say, well, gee, why is that a surprise? I wouldn't say it's necessarily a surprise in the current environment, especially, as I said, given the level of Chinese maliciousness and how that's in the public mind. But, you know, it was only a generation ago that the court was far more skeptical of the executive branch's decisions in this regard. Look at the Pentagon Papers cases and its progeny. So we're clearly seeing a significant shift on the Supreme Court. And then in terms of the overall issue of how this is going to be resolved, I believe it will be handled at a sort of macro political level between China and the United States, if at all, and some corporate deal will be found that is satisfactory or not, as the case may be. If there are lots of impediments to a deal here, very significant economics here. Finally, more broadly, as I've said before, I think this whole situation is emblematic and illustrative of the fact that we do not have a clear, integrated, coherent view of how we want to accept the benefits of and mitigate the risks of Chinese technology. We're perfectly happy having every Chinese router and video camera in our home because they're cheap and easy and convenient, and yet we're sitting ducks in terms of surveillance issues. And we do not have, at the national level, a coherent strategy for dealing with Chinese technology. And we instead have a bit of a whack-a-mole, and this is Exhibit A in that. That's going to be a big issue for the next decade, and we'll see how that plays out.
Last thought on that. It's not just Chinese tech companies that I think pose some concern. I would just say that in the last week, Microsoft has deployed a tool, which is an AI tool capable of using whatever you're doing, you know, to feed its model known as Copilot. And after deploying that, many Microsoft users sought to have it removed. And I'm sure a lot of those people were mindful of the fact that they didn't want their data being used. We still don't have a data privacy law in the United States that would widely apply to any of the bigs, any companies. There are lots of state laws. But as it turns out, Microsoft is unable to remove this tool. This is the kind of thing with these big tech companies where we're walking on the moon. You know, this is not terra firma. This is a level of concern and insanity at times that I just don't think we're prepared to deal with. And there doesn't seem to be any single governmental agency that is really looking at all of this very holistically. And everybody is still siloed with whatever their legal authorities are as an executive branch agency. But I think the new administration has massive challenges ahead of it dealing with this. One, and two, I continue to be concerned that Congress is not still fulfilling its mission as lawmaker, fact finder, and so on. And I certainly hope that this level of, you know, sort of absenteeism by members of Congress, maybe, I don't know what to say. This stuff should be published at the time of elections widely so people can know, even if you like a person and you think they are advancing your agenda, are they even there to do it? I think that there is a tendency to view some of these concerns as alarmist, but knowledge is a powerful thing. Glenn, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. You are a delight, and we really appreciate your knowledge and experience.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. Always wonderful to chat with you too.
Our guests tonight, our guests plural, have been Brian Egan, presently a partner at Skadden Arps, as well as Glenn Gerstel, who is former general counsel of NSA. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of NSLT. Make sure you share this episode with a friend or a colleague and discuss the issues we've raised thoughtfully. That's always a good idea. Hear other people's arguments. It makes you a better lawyer. Remember, if you like our podcast and you enjoy our content, it's very important for you to review us if you can on your listening app of choice. It takes less than a minute. You can also subscribe, and that is helpful to our ongoing efforts here to provide you with free thoughtful content. If you want to reach out to us, you always can. You can even do it by emailing us at nationalsecurity@americanbar.org. We remain at this time on X, and you can find us at ABANATSEC. Our writer and producer and host is me, Elisa Poteet, but keep in mind, I am always here in my individual capacity. Our editor and my co-producer is the lovely Frances Burkham. My co-producer is also Holly McMahon, who can do 50 things at the same time. Maybe she could solve all these problems because she has that range of thought and ability ongoing. But mostly, I just want to thank all the members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security, without whom this podcast would not be possible. Stay tuned, and we'll see you next time.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.